All right, I think we can start. So welcome to the robotics seminar, new term. For the first talk, we are very happy to have Marcel Just, who is one of the premier experts in fMRI studies, along many other things. He is head professor of psychology right here at CMU, and he's also the director for the Center of Cognitive Brain Imaging. So the idea was to get to know our own community a little bit more and to hopefully see if there is some kind of connection that we can draw between our end, which is, you know, trying to make human-like machines, and the psychology end, where they are studying the real thing and maybe have better insights about how it works. So Marcel has numerous awards. One of them is National Institute of Mental Health Research Scientist and Senior Scientist Award. And he has been working in the field for many, many years and has been at the eye on many of the projects. And I think that if something in his talk strikes you as having connections to the work that you do, I encourage you to talk to Marcel afterwards, and maybe there is some kind of a collaboration that we could find between RI and the center. So thank you very much for coming.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. I see surprisingly many familiar faces in the audience, so that's always nice, feeling at home. I have a microphone I can use. If anybody at the back thinks I need it, just wave your hand. But it sort of feels kind of intimate in here, so let me try without. So very roughly speaking, what I'm going to talk about is what, if one tried to characterize the human operating system, how would you describe it based on fMRI studies and what's known about human thought? That's roughly the topic of my talk today. So I'm going to talk about a cognitive neuroarchitecture. It's called 4CAPS. The person that I've worked with for the longest time on this is Shashank Varma, and more recently Vince Malave and Kaiman Chang, who's sitting here. The talk is divided. I'm going to talk about some 4CAPS properties, but really I'm going to talk about the cortical function that suggests the 4CAPS properties, how you can infer some of these design properties of the system from the brain activity. I'll show you how models, computational models that are written in 4CAPS, correspond to some of the human performance data and brain activity. And 4CAPS is one neuroarchitecture. I'll describe two or three others, so you can sort of see the space of possibilities, of choices, just having one kind of unusual architecture is difficult to evaluate. But when you see others, you can see the space of choices in which ones we've made and why. So let me show you the first principle. You probably already know this, but when you're thinking, it's always a set of cortical areas that activates. If you think that the visual task is done by the visual cortex, you're wrong. There's no task that only activates the visual cortex. Something else is going to activate. And the number of areas that activates, this is from a sentence comprehension task, and you can see very clearly, depending on how you want to count this, you want to say this is four or five clusters and as many on the other side. So it's like 10, 15 very clear areas of activation, clusters of voxels that activate. There's some arbitrariness of what you want to call activate, because it's all a matter of thresholding. But clearly, every thinking thought, what you're doing now is, you know, like 12 areas or something. This is an aside. I thought maybe some of you might be interested in how you do an fMRI study. So you take a conventional MRI scanner, maybe tuned just a little bit better than usual, and you put somebody in it. You can put visual stimuli on a screen behind them, project it. You can make them wear earphones. You can put buttons in their hands. And this is what it looks like more realistically. They're lying in the scanner. This is called a head coil, which is, well, among other things, it's a glorified antenna for receiving the very faint signals, the MR signals. So that, and here, this is sort of intended to depict a driving simulator. I'll show you about that later. So in this case, the subject can sit there and steer a car along a road while riding, lying in the scanner perfectly still, at least their head. Just a little more detail, maybe more neat, is you can use these reflecting mirrors right above the subject's eyes so they can see the screen behind them. Or you can use VR goggles that are MR compatible. So there, you know, you're off to the races. It's limited only by your imagination and a good technician. Okay, so here's the second principle. First was many areas activate. And secondly is the set of areas is self-assembled dynamically as a function of the task demands. So as I'm talking now, there's a set of areas doing language comprehension. But if I said in the middle of my sentence that I want you to multiply 14 times 6, I'll suddenly recruit those additional areas. You'll suddenly, you know, without having to press any buttons, those areas that multiply at 14 times 6 will come into play on their own. So this is the self-assembly. This is an illustration of what? I think this is right hemisphere. Yeah, right hemisphere. Sometimes people think language is a left hemisphere function. And this measures the amount of activation, recruitment of the right hemisphere as a function of sentence complexity. So if you have an extremely simple sentence, you know, the pen is on the table, you don't need any help from the right hemisphere. But as you make that sentence harder, make it an object relative, the senator, the reporter attacked, admitted the error, who did the attacking, then the right hemisphere comes to play. So here's a set of processors. They're sitting there available, watching what's going on. And when their appropriate computational ability is called for, they jump in. So that's the second point. I just showed you in the previous slide that the right hemisphere comes to play if the sentence is hard. This shows a patient, here it says 3 days after stroke. 3 days after stroke, this is the left hemisphere, in this case it's Broca's area, is damaged by stroke. There's no more activation. And what this shows, this activation shows, is that immediately after the stroke, the right hemisphere comes to play. It jumps in. It knows that, you know, there's a sentence, this is in sentence comprehension. There's some language processing to be done, and it jumps in. Now, this person was probably 55 years old when he had his stroke. And how did this area know to jump in? Well, for the previous 54 years, it'd been jumping in whenever the sentences were hard, whenever the load was great. So it's used to sort of playing this understudy role. And here it is, 3 days after stroke, no therapy, no medication. It's already ready to do the job. So it's as though you're carrying around, I don't want to say spare parts, but, well, backup parts. Parts that can, as in a, not quite as efficiently as the original ones, can do the job. Okay, here's another example of the dynamic recruitment. Now, the intention is to show you how quickly and easily it happens. So this is a verbal problem solving test. The day before my favorite day is the first day after Monday. So what's my favorite day? And you work this out. So if I give you this kind of problem that requires this kind of computation, you get this extra recruitment of the prefrontal cortex, DLPFC. And you can see how, and you know, it happens at a particular point in time. This is averaged over, I don't know, 12 subjects. So you see again, in a context of slightly different tasks, this dynamic recruitment of various players as the need arises. When I say recruitment, maybe that's not a good word. I think it's self-recruitment. It's like players sitting on the bench knowing to jump in at the right time.
Marcel, what would that graph show?
This shows the activation. This is time on the x-axis. So this is the hemodynamic response function, but you see that you get, and this is all for the left DLPFC, prefrontal cortex. If you make, this is the harder condition where there's a problem-solving element involved. If I just said the day that is my favorite day is the first day after Monday, you know, without...
The contrast is the pink are the hard problems, the blue is the easy.
Correct.
Okay, I wasn't sure if it was that or the different areas. Thanks.
So it's the same area with or without a problem-solving need.
Thanks.
Here's the third principle. The activation, I say it's in a comprehension task, but in almost any task, is synchronized across the participating area. So they're not all doing their own thing. They're working together, and they're working in networks as well. How do we know this? The main method is to look at the time series correlation. So if you, this is image number, this is collected at a coarse sampling rate, but now we do it at one image per second. Once per second, we get a point along these lines. And here are two areas. This is Broca's and DLPFC. And you see they track each other pretty well. And you can use techniques like factor analysis or whatever to, if you have 12 areas, you can say, oh, these five are working together and these other three are working together and so on and so forth if their time courses are synchronized. This isn't direct evidence that they're communicating, but there's some evidence, but it's some evidence of coordination, of course. And so you can segment out the set of, I don't know, 10, 15 areas into these networks. And they are communicating. And it's not just feed forward either. It's not like, you know, seeing a flash of light or a checkerboard and sort of just an upstream thing. This is a thought process. You know, on all the examples I gave you, you know, the one about the favorite day or something, this is not a sort of a simple upstream recognition process. There's problem solving to be done. There's thought, there's a computation. If I ask you to multiply, I don't know, 147 times 9, there's work to be done, mental work, and it's not upstream. It's sort of back and forth, represent this, transform this, store that, coordinate here, there. So it's that kind of a computational system that the brain is. It's not just for perceiving simple objects. Okay, a little bit more to say about the synchronization of activation across areas. First of all, this is a jargon issue. This is called functional connectivity. I don't want to defend that label. I didn't make it up. It's just a label. So here's some interesting things about the synchronization. It increases with learning. As you, in several tasks, this has been shown, as you get more and more proficient at the task, the more synchronized the areas are. Typically, at the same time, the activation levels are going down. So they're learning to play better together. It's obviously a network property. And here, let me allude, in one of the most interesting outgrowths of this approach is that in our research on autism, we've discovered that one of the main markers of thought process in autism is a lack or a lower degree of synchronization among the brain areas. And you can just measure that directly in autism, particularly between frontal and more posterior areas. And you can correlate that lower synchronization with the properties of the white matter that carry the communication. So you can measure the corpus callosum. More than that, you can measure a particular part of the corpus callosum that, say, carries the fiber that contains the fibers going from one particular brain area to another particular brain area. And the synchronization between those brain areas is correlated with the size of that part of the corpus callosum. So you see that the synchronization and communication, I think, is an important system property in human thought. Okay. I think I have two things labeled three, but maybe you can let that go. Another point is that the brain activity that we measure is an index of the computational workload, the cognitive workload. So here I've given you, this is for just one subject, comprehending a moderately simple sentence, a sentence of intermediate complexity, and a complex sentence. And what I want to point out is how the activation increases. You see the topographic regularity of the activation. It's not just random voxels anywhere. It's the tissue in this area. It happens to be Wernicke's area. The tissue in this area has to work harder as you make the sentence processing harder. And you can just see that this recruitment of the tissue, its volume and its intensity with the computational workload. This was one subject in the previous slide. This is a graph showing, I don't know, maybe 15 subjects of this area where the activation, this is the number of voxels, so it's a volumetric measure in this case, increasing as I make the sentence task harder. So that's this again in a mental rotation task. So this is maybe of slightly more interest to you. If I ask people to decide whether these two structures are the same or not, the way they do it is they mentally transform the orientation of one until they intend to match the transformations and compare the structures. Match the orientations and compare the structures. And you can manipulate the angle through which this has to be rotated. So that's what's on the x-axis, the angle in which they have to rotate it mentally in order to decide whether the same or different. This is just for same trials. And here again, the volume of activation, this time is in left parietal area, increasing, well, almost linearly with the angular disparity. The farther you have to rotate, the harder that area has to work. This is, you probably don't know, this is the Tower of London task. I bet you all know Tower of Hanoi. For present purposes, let's pretend it's very similar. And as you increase problem difficulty, you get increased activation in left ELPFC. So another system property is that each area activates more and more, depending on the demand, but of course up to some limit. Okay, so now resource constraints and multitasking. So why is it that we can't do seven things at a time? We have all these brain areas. You know, people tell you you're using 10% of your brain at any one time, which is an overstatement, by the way. Why can't you do seven things at one time? What's the limiting factor? So we studied a couple of tasks that could be done either alone or concurrently. And I think there's some very interesting results. Again, implications about what the important parts of the system are and what the choke points might be. So here's there are two tasks that we did either alone or together. One task was auditory sentence comprehension. People listening to sentences like biology is a discipline that studies human life in various forms, something like that. The spatial task is the mental rotation task I just showed you. And these bars show you the amount of activation in different areas. The clear parts of the bar show you the left and right temporal, which is an area that activates during auditory sentence comprehension, includes Wernicke's area, and the diagonally striped bar is in the parietal area, about which I'll have more to say later, which is the transformational, the perceptual transformation area. So if you do the single, if you just do sentence comprehension, it's almost all temporal, very little parietal. If you just do mental rotation, it's almost all parietal, no temporal. And this is a theoretical bar. This is just a stacking of these two bars. If you did both together, what would happen? And that's my question to you. If you did both simultaneously, and it's not too hard. Well, I shouldn't say not too hard. Some CMU students can do both simultaneously. They can do mental rotation while they're listening to someone talk and deciding whether a sentence is true or false. So the question is, what happens when they're doing these two things simultaneously? And I put down some alternatives. It could be additive, because there could be neural system autonomy. It could just be the sum of columns 1 and 2. You know, these areas do this thing, this area does that thing, and they could just do them at the same time. Or you could get over-additivity because of some co-performance cost. Right? Makes sense. Or there could be under-additivity because of some overall capacity constraint. Right? So I think all three of these seem plausible to me. After I show you the result, you'll say, oh, sure, of course, I knew that all along. All right, so why don't you mentally register your vote? And here's the result. There's gross under-additivity. The amount of activation associated with sentence comprehension is much smaller here than here. I don't know, it's like 40%, maybe even less. And this is like 35% of this. No, that doesn't look, it goes down by 65% of this. So an enormous decrease in the amount of activation when you're doing, in the key areas, when you're doing two tasks simultaneously. The error rates, let me do this slide and I'll get your question. We trained people so they could do this, so that they're answering true-false, and their accuracy here, as you see, doesn't go down in the dual case. Their reaction time, responding true-false, is longer, 200 milliseconds longer. The mental rotation, again, the accuracy, this is the error rate, 7.8% versus 12%, but you see that they're still doing it fairly accurately. Okay.
It was basically this.
Okay. Not quite is the answer, but... Okay, so the obvious application of this is use of a cell phone during driving. And you know, you can forget about the hands-free issue, dialing. Just imagine you have a speakerphone, cell phone, and you're driving along and you're talking to someone. Is that going to hurt you? Well, you already saw the laboratory version of the study. I'm not going to run this little... demo here of the driving simulator and somebody talking at the same time. But I'm sure you've experienced some point where you're driving in demanding traffic and somebody's talking to you, and it's not a pleasant feeling. So let me show you the findings from this study. So this is the driving-related activation when you're just driving. And this is what happens when you're driving and listening at the same time. Now, you don't really have to run this fMRI experiment. You could just drive behind the person and see how much they're weaving. But this tells you why. There's sort of less brain computational apparatus going into the lane maintenance here. And this is just with no emergency, no air hazard avoidance or anything like that. Yes, that's right. I mean, it's reliable. You're still performing the task. I mean, they're not going off the side of the road, off the cliff. But we measure, for example, how often they hit the berm. You know, there's sort of a virtual berm. We measure the number of hits of the berm, which is reliably more in the listening case. I also measure deviation RMSD from an ideal path. So they weave more.
So this is because it takes longer, the processing takes longer so that the corrections happen later than they should, right?
Not necessarily. You imply that if we just introduce the lag, so to speak, it would be...
So in laboratory experiments, there was a lag, right? Things just took longer.
But I don't think it just... But longer doesn't just mean later.
But is this an artifact of your ability to better measure performance in driving? I mean, previously... Mental
location
is about the same.
No. I didn't say it was about... I said you're still performing the task. So the error rate goes from 7.8% to 12.3%. The reaction time goes from 2400 to 2800. So people are capable of doing the two tasks simultaneously. They don't just stop doing one. They're continuing, and they're doing... Well, you can see at that level. At that level. Jack?
You mentioned that they've been trained to do both at once. What does the picture look like before they receive training?
Well, one interesting thing is this isn't the hardest dual task that we ask people to do. The hardest...
You already are trained in this task.
Well, when I say trained, I mean you can't just take people out of the hall and say, do this, because they need warm-up to do the dual tasking. But let me say a little bit about this. Not everybody can do it, even among CMU students. So it's hard. And there's some, I think one of our hardest tasks is listening to two people at the same time. Listening to two people talk, we put it in, you know, two different ears, a male and a female voice. And I think we have a very high washout rate among the, especially among the males, who have a hard time doing that. And even... And that isn't even part of our data. The people who wash out never get into our studies. That's just sort of in the screening. So what I'm trying to describe what happens if you can multitask, but not everybody can. I think it's kind of interesting, you know, who can or who can't. How would I predict that? Maybe at the end of my talk we could get around that. I'm not sure that I can. I know where I would look.
Did you test any autistics?
Yes. You know, there's another study. I didn't bring it today, but there's a study where they match up autistic and control subjects so that they're performing equally on the two tasks, on the two single tasks. And then they combine the tasks, and the performance of the dual tasking performance of the people with autism is very substantially lower. That's where you were headed, right?
Yeah.
And that actually, so I hope I come back to that, because I haven't told you why I think this phenomenon occurs. Why is it that the activation goes down? You know, this area is not being used for listening. Oh, so this is a New York Times article on this, on the first study. So it's, car calls leave the brain shorthanded. So here's the beginnings of a theoretical account of the dual task results. So in the single task, an automatic task is performed with more resources than absolutely necessary. So remember, we have to take relatively automatic tasks. At least one of them has to be relatively automatic. You put two very highly controlled strategic tasks, and that's just not doable by anybody. But driving and listening is about as automatic as two high-level tasks can be. So in the dual-mode task, a system-wide resource constraint kicks in. And that's really what I want to talk about in a few minutes. What's the system-wide resource that constrains this? Reducing the available resources for each component task. The two tasks execute as two parallel streams with little executive control. I didn't mention this. But, you know, when you have to think about what you're doing, planning out, first I'll do this, then I'll do that, and sort of if you're doing it consciously, there's a lot of frontal activation, controlling things, coordinating things. In these dual tasks that I'm showing you, there's very little frontal activation. Okay? It's really two streams running concurrently, threads, maybe you want to call them, two threads running concurrently with very little executive control to coordinate them. So let me say a little bit about forecaps. So it came from an earlier system that was really behavioral, sort of in the SOAR and ACT-R era. And it was a predecessor system. But as we started doing these fMRI studies and sort of seeing the underlying architecture, it was obvious that we couldn't account properly for the fMRI data. And so we had this fMRI data on a number of kinds of high-level tasks. We wanted to account for 10 to 15 cortical areas co-activating with different activation levels and time courses. Wanted to account for patient damage and recovery, the dynamic system configuration, and so on. So the forecaps, the processing, forecaps is more than anything a production system, but it's a confederation of, you know, 10, 12 production systems. But they're a hybrid in nature. They have a lot of connectionist properties. They propagate activation. So in a way, you could think of them as a dynamic link between nodes in the neural network. But they're high level. high-level links, so you can have, you know, sort of arbitrarily complex Boolean combinations and so on. Here's what it stands for. It's concurrent, it's cortical, it's capacity constraint, it's activation-based. So that's what the four C's are about. So here's some distinguishing characteristics of four CAPs. Its components, it's the system components are cortical correspond to cortical processing centers. Each one is a production system with several connections properties. It's parallel, the productions fire and parallel their activation base. Secondly, the system is resource constrained, as all biological systems are. The individual centers have resource upper bounds. You can't just go and, you know, hold an infinite number of digits in working memory. You can't perceive, you know, an indefinite number of people's faces simultaneously and so on. They're just resource constraints. And there are also system-wide constraints. And now here's the system-wide constraint that I've been hinting with. I think it's the cortical communication bandwidth. I told you that thinking is done by teams of processors. And I think that one of the limiting resources is the communication bandwidth among the processors. And I would say my hypothesis is about why you can't do too many tasks simultaneously. It's not because it's two areas that have to work simultaneously. It's two networks that have to do simultaneously. And the intranetwork communication, I think, is disrupted by the other network's intranetwork communication. And I think that that's the limiting factor. I think it's an interesting hypothesis. You know, wouldn't have arisen 10 years ago. But now you can sort of see some of this stuff. You can measure, you know, you can actually go and measure in people what you can measure is the outside cable diameter. But still, it correlates with some of the properties of the information transfer.
Could you elaborate on what you meant by parallel in point one? Do you mean that the production systems operate in parallel to each other or within?
Both. Within each center, so suppose you have a frontal center, all the enabled productions fire at the same time. There's no conflict resolution. At the same time, at a slightly more molar level, while productions are firing the frontal area, they're also firing in other areas. So there's parallelism in both senses.
So if there are two networks, and you see corresponding interference, if you will, aren't they really the same network? Or else there's a third contributing outside factor?
If I have two networks working, operating simultaneously,
and you see them both degrade.
Yes.
Aren't they really the same network? Or else there's a third factor interfering with both of them?
Well, I don't know what you mean by aren't they the same network. If I study the, if I measure, for example, the individual correlations or factor analysis of their time courses, I'll see them group into two networks, two separate networks. But really, imagine like two teams of anything, of people doing some job, and imagine if they had to shout across the same room to each other versus each team in a separate room. I don't know, I just made that little analogy up, but.
So the air in the room becomes part of the bandwidth.
Mm-hmm.
Of the same. Really
that's right. Log. Right, but suppose they were using walkie-talkies or something.
Okay.
One other question about the coordination among the cortical processing centers. Within a production system, every production can read the entire working memory. Were you going to elaborate further on that?
A little bit. In four CAPs, in some of the systems, everybody sees all the processing centers sees everything. In some ways, it's the blackboard model. Okay, there are elaborations of this, namely each representational element has an activation level. But in this case, it's not a scalar; it's a vector, and the vectors correspond to each of the centers that are supporting that element's activations and support. So you can make representational elements visible to other centers or not. Typically, the way we've run it is it's all one big blackboard.
cities and you can draw the scale, the whole city, accordingly, in fine detail. Is this basically a bandwidth issue that you have because maybe you're autistic in the brain? That
well, first of all, you know, you don't want to go just on individual anecdotes, but in the citations of people with autism capturing detail, usually they have the scene in front of them as they draw it. They don't do it from memory. But you know, on the other hand, there are exquisite feats of memorization by people with autism. But I don't think you have to postulate any sort of exceptional machinery there. You have to postulate exceptional motivation and interest and so on, and time on task. But I don't think, you might ask me, how's the architecture different in autism? Let me answer in a few minutes.
You said normally you run in a global Blackboard thing where every production can see everything.
Mm-hmm.
So if I understand correctly, the only thing sense in which the production system is factored into cortical processing centers is that each production is deemed to be, is labeled belong to a particular center.
Also, we limit the activation available to each center. So that's right. But when it comes to the communication bandwidth, if everybody can put anything on the blackboard, then there is no communication limitation. And so it's only when we go to model autism or multitasking that it really comes into play, that forces us to say, no, this is wrong. The blackboard isn't infinitely large. That's one way to put it.
So if they are sharing some sort of channel, what is that channel biologically? Or is it some sort of process inside?
Okay, so it could literally be the axons, the white matter. You know, I don't know what proportion of the brain, 40%, does anybody know? Large proportion of the brain is white matter. It's sort of cabling. You know, so if you think about what's the computational infrastructure of Newell, Simon, Hall, and you'll probably point to, you know, CPUs, and you'll forget to point to all of the cable trays. But maybe all of those cable trays and routers are as critical, and maybe that's what distinguishes CMU from Purdue or something. Maybe they have the same number of CPUs, but they don't have less wonderful cabling. Maybe bandwidth, literally, in some case, you know, how many, you know, megabytes or whatever per second can they transmit? Maybe, you know, so when you think of network computing in that sense, you know, the communication bandwidth is a key issue. And what I'm saying is, maybe in human thought, this coordination is a key issue. Now, you asked me a question, and I gave a very, I think, precise answer, but I'm not as confident as maybe I sounded when I say that. That's a hypothesis. We test it, we measure it, we're getting some initial results. But consistent with that, you know, what measurement of the physical brain correlates best with intelligence? Everybody used to think, oh, volume. Well, it's the easiest thing to measure. So I find it just startling that the matter of the white volume gives you among the highest correlations with intelligence. So it's literally like measuring the cables. Who would have thought? You know, it just seems counterintuitive, doesn't it? Well, so, but there could be other kinds of, there, an alternative possibility is really some bioenergetic kind of factor. I mean, so it's obviously an electrochemical system, so something more analogous maybe to a power supply, right? You have only so many amps to go around, and, you know, if you go too high, you'll get a brownout. So I can't be sure that what I'm saying is right. It's certainly an interesting hypothesis, and initially is sort of panning out.
There's this theory that actually we communicate by frequencies in the brainwaves, and the reason. reason we can have so many wranglers?
Well, it could, you know, it's certainly possible that, information is frequency coded. You know, I could take a spatial task and I could say, well, it's all Fourier analysis in the brain, and you could say that's a frequency code. And, you know, and certainly there are aspects of brain activity that correspond to frequency differences in modulation and coding and so on. So I don't want to argue against frequency. But, you know, most of the time when you're thinking, when you're comprehending language, if I say, how did you understand this sentence? How did you decompose the grammar and so on? I think it's a long stretch from that to a frequency-based system. There are facets, you know, if you analyze the frequency of the electrical activity, there's a systematic relation to thought processes. That's true. I don't think that's the basis on which the brain operates. I think it's just an emergent characteristic. But I could be wrong. So let me say something about the processing centers. I haven't to date. So they correspond to brain areas. When I'm talking about processing centers, I'm thinking of something that has a diameter of about a centimeter, maybe 2 centimeters, that order of magnitude. And they're not the conventional components of a cognitive architecture. You know, the pieces of forecaps don't look like the pieces of SOAR or ACTAR. So what distinguishes them? Why are there 12 of them? Why isn't there one or two? How do they differ? They're characterized, I think, by their computational style, as inferred from cognitive neuroscience imaging and patient studies. So let me give you an example maybe would be, I think, is of most relevance in robotics, and that's the interparietal sulcus area. I think, you know, people say it's used for imagery, it's used for visual processing, it's used for reaching, it's for perceptual motor coordination. I think that's all kind of true, but not the central truth. I think the central truth is that it's the geometric engine of the system. All that, you know, all that matrix multiplication that you're doing in your robotics work, I think, corresponds to the intraparietal sulcus activity in the human brain. Well, I showed you the mental rotation data, you know, increasing with the amount of rotation angle. It's IPS, it's exactly that area that increases with the rotation angle. And it's used for a lot of things. It's sort of your also spatial attention. But, you know, some facets of thought obviously have a spatial, I don't know what to call it, basis or correlate. If you're thinking, you know, if you're doing your architectural work or your mechanical engineering work, there's a dimensionality to it. There's a sort of a spatial distribution, maybe three-dimensionality. But when you're processing language, spatiality is not central. I mean, obviously you can talk about spatial things, but it's different. It's propositional, you know, relations and properties.
In regard to mental rotation or any other kind of task, do you see sometimes if there is a switch as you increase the difficulty of the task, suddenly it goes from one area to another? For example, for mental rotation, if the two objects are very close to each other, maybe you don't need the spatial reasoning. Maybe just a simple pattern matcher would do, and then it might, you know, as it realizes that the problem is harder, it switches to another area. Do you see anything like that?
So I characterize this as a recruitment of additional areas on an as-needed basis, a just-in-time as-needed basis. So absolutely. The one that you see, you see that most often when you need a strategic component, and then you see the recruitment of frontal areas. That happens. If I ask you to do sentence comprehension and I say, you know, biology is my favorite subject, that's one thing. But if I say the capital letter B rotated 90 degrees clockwise looks a little bit like, I don't know, 2 ice cream scoops or something. All right, so for the latter, you'll get the IPS activation, and for the former, you won't. Now,
can you predict if say, if the first area gets oversaturated, and then you can say, oh, that's when the second gets in. You can predict when it...
Well, I'd like to think so. The model predicts it. We do studies. It's not a perfect fit yet. And we refer to that as spillover. I think that the areas have a specialization and efficiency with which they can do any particular computation, and that the secondary areas to which they spill over have lower efficiencies. You only use them when you need them. And you see some of that in mental rotation. You see it more in language. But, you know, I think in this task actually left IPS, I think, is primary, and you see a little bit more left IPS. But, well, okay. Let me go to my second example. I think this is interesting. What are the sort of the components of the system? The second one I want to talk about is left inferior frontal gyrus, or pars opercularis, or part of Broca's area. I think it's the builder of structured representations, you know, containing hierarchical labeled relations, lets you do recursion. I think this is the glory of the human mind. As you know, sort of chimps have wonderful spatial ability, can sort of jump through trees better than we can. Well, maybe not chimps, but monkeys. And, you know, they can grab things faster and better, but they can't understand object relative sentences very well, and we can. And I think it's because of this area that builds structured representations. And this is an area adjacent to the motor area, and I think the motor area, in a sense, has to build structured representations. So I want to reach for this control, and it's at this distance, and it has a certain hardness, and I'm going to move at this rate. And so you build, you're more familiar with this than I am, so you build a representation of the motion and the actions that will get you to your goal. This was already present in predecessor brains, and I think that language built off this. It's in a spatially contiguous area, and so now you can build not motor actions, but instead you can build complex thoughts. It's like little Legos where an individual proposition is like two pieces, you know, something like birds fly. So that's your basic proposition, but you can say, I'm glad that birds fly, and you get the embedding, recursion, and you can build a fairly complex thought, and other people will understand it. Now, it's not indefinitely complex, because, you know, if I give you enough embeddings, you'll get lost. But if you read Henry James, you see the extent to which the human mind is capable of producing and understanding this kind of symbolic structure. And that's what I attribute to this part of the frontal cortex, the left inferior frontal gyrus. So I don't think it's just syntactic processing. I think it's for generating complex visuospatial representations. You know, if I want an arch on top of something else that's under something else, I think it's involved in that. Oh, yeah, when I gave you my rotate the B sentence, of course you had to understand the syntax in order to generate the visual image.
Is there actually anatomical evidence that chimps don't have that area, or that it's smaller?
There's a very interesting article that relates the chimp area properties to the human area properties. I can't think of the researcher's name just this instant, but it'll come to me. I think it's extremely interesting. So here's a third example, posterior left temporal gyrus, Wernicke's area. I think it retrieves language-based associations. So as you hear my words, as you recognize the syntax, you have to retrieve what it means. It's got to be stored somewhere. And I think this is this is the place that initiates the retrieval. I'm not saying that it's stored there, but I think this is the indexing point. So I've given you three examples of three of my favorite centers. I didn't bother talking about the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, which is sort of like the goal manager that you see prominent in problem solving. It's saying, I want to do this, but I'm stuck here, so I'm going to sub-goal and do this, and so on. All right, so here's the summary. I'm not sure there's anything new here. Multiple centers. Inter-center collaboration. I didn't say much, but I think there are multiple specializations per center. some redundancy of function across center, but with different efficiencies, center resource constraints, and system resource constraints, and dynamic self-organization. And importantly, not a one-to-one mapping between process and center. By that I mean, you know, conventionally defined psychological process like syntactic processing. Here's some of the tasks that we've modeled. Maybe I'll show you some of these. So sentence comprehension. So we have a small natural language understanding system that accounts for some of the behavioral data and some of the fMRI data, Tower of London, mental rotation, the driving simulator, Tower of Hanoi, dual tasking, mental rotation, sentence comprehension, and so on.
What do you mean by single item versus I
regret that this is here. It's two different kinds of fMRI studies, but this is sort of a block diagram of the language processing system. But this is a reading time of different kinds of sentence. These are actives, these are passives, these are datives. I don't remember what the other ones stand for. But there are 11 types of sentences increasing in complexity, and the model processing time increases kind of like the human processing time. But I'd like to show you the fMRI modeling. So on this graph, so here's a complex sentence. The pundit that the attacked admitted the gaffe. Each curve here is a different brain area. Let's look at the upper two curves, which is left IFG and left Broca's and Wernicke's areas. And as you get deeper and deeper into the sentence, when you get to the hard part, you're really using a lot, you're really drawing on those areas a lot, so you get more activation. But you can saturate that area, and as you begin to saturate it around here, you see the recruitment of the corresponding counterpart right hemisphere areas. So this approach to saturation evokes the processing of the right hemisphere homologs. So this is in time. So the system is given the words of the sentence sequentially. Now, you know, fMRI doesn't measure neural activity directly. It measures the oxygenated blood that is a consequent of the neural activation, and it's smeared out over time and averaged. It's called the hemodynamic response function. And so here, what happens in about 4.5 seconds of listening or reading and comprehension gets smeared out in the fMRI response over about 11 or 12 seconds. Now, this is still modeling. There's no fMRI here, but there's a model of the hemodynamic response function. It's a particular form of a gamma transformation. So I can take these five curves, gamma transform them, and get these hypothetical fMRI functions. What I'm going to show you in the bottom graph is the actual fMRI data. So we can model the activity of the brain over time, and moreover the hemodynamic response that we measure with the fMRI. This is on language ambiguity. Let me not do that right now. I showed you before the spontaneous recovery from brain damage, and the way we modeled it was we simply lesion the. Oh no! This is the actual. This is unlesioned, just normal subjects. This is the progressive recruitment of the right hemisphere as you make the sentences harder. I had previously shown you these little gray bars in fMRI, and here are the new model gray bars here. This is the modeling of the multitasking. When you put in the system-wide constraint, the bandwidth constraint, you can get the under additivity. This also in driving. So I want to talk briefly, I'm running out of time here, about comparison to other architectures. I'm going to talk about three. One is called a large-scale neural model. The main investigator is Barry Horowitz. And it's really, you know, if a neural networker wanted to simulate fMRI, how would you do it? So the basic computational unit is a population of neuronal pairs. Excitatory inhibitory plays a key role intended to correspond to a hypercolumn and one or more populations to model each brain area. I have a picture of it in a minute. Synthetic PET is something that Michael Arbib is doing, and he characterizes the system, you know, the neuroarchitecture, as cooperative computation between a number of brain areas, each of which is modeled as an array of neural elements, and each element is modeled as a leaky integrator. So you can sort of see this convergence of information. And ACTR is our own John Anderson's adaptation of ACTR to what's becoming more and more known about brain activity, where the components of the system of ACTR, as it was, I don't know, 10 or 15 years ago, John is looking for brain areas that correspond to those architectural components. So here's a picture of Horowitz's large-scale neural net model. So you can see, so this is IT here, sort of a favorite of vision researchers, V1, V2. And so here he models some visual perception tasks with this kind of approach. So now, here's the first slide showing some comparisons. So I hope I'm not doing a sales job on saying here's how wonderful 4CAPS is. And as evidence of my Catholicism here, I want to show you what the operating principles all the architectures share. Because presumably this is something you should believe. If all the major researchers think so, maybe it's true. So there's obviously multiple centers in the brain. Everybody knows that. There's collaborative processing. Everybody knows that. And there's multiple functions per center. Everybody knows that. So there are some, I think, you know, sort of current scientific truths. But there's some principles that only some architectures share. 4CAPS and synthetic PET think that there's multiple centers per function. There's redundancy of function across centers. The others don't. And 4CAPS very clearly subscribes the idea of resource constraints within centers and within the system. So that's distinguishing. So here are some operating principles unique to CAPS. 4CAPS here. So the multi-center resource constraints, that they're system-wide constraints, maybe this bandwidth constraint, and this dynamic system configuration, that it changes on the fly. And here's some commonalities between 4CAPS and ACTR. So they both use as an empirical basis cognitive functional data, performance and high-level tasks, not low-level perception tasks. So it's fairly complex phenomenon. The computational mechanisms are fairly hybrid. By contrast, Horowitz and Arbib really limit themselves to neural network mechanisms. Here's some commonalities in 4CAPS and the other cognitive architectures. Really the bottom two lines. So are the centers full-fledged processors? In ACTR, they're buffers. And really the sort of, I'm to call it, the main, I don't even know what to call it, production system interpreter lives in the basal ganglia. So even when you're doing the geometric processing in IPS, according to ACTR, is just a buffer. And the productions are, I don't know, controlled or living elsewhere. Intercenter relations, they're kind of heterarchical in most of the systems in ACTR. For the reasons I just described, they're hierarchical. So, running out of time. So, I should stop. Let me see how many more slides I have.
5 minutes.
Okay. Autism. What is autism? I think autism is a lowered bandwidth constraint, particularly between frontal and parietal areas. You can see that in the synchronization. You can see that in the measurement of some of the white matter. And so many of the unusual behaviors that you see in autism could be interpreted in those terms that you have a decreased frontal executive participation in the processing, and a somewhat, sometimes a compensatory posterior participation. So it seems kind of enigmatic, But people with autism are slightly better at spotting embedded figures than control subjects. Why would that be? What a weird little talent. Well, the reason is, I think, because there's less top-down processing in people with autism. Why would that be? Because the top is the prefrontal cortex, and it might have poor connections, so it doesn't have an opportunity to exercise that influence. And I can go through and name a number of those kinds of things. Oh, so you get more activation during language comprehension in autism, you get more activation in a posterior language area, sort of a word-oriented, a sort of a lexically driven processing, and less activation in the frontal syntactic, thematic, organizational processing. So a lot of the enigma of autism begins to be explained from this perspective.
So, an older theory about autism was it was overstimulation. They had to shut down input to the brain because they somehow couldn't dampen it. So how do you relate that older idea to this idea?
Well, there is some truth to the issue of attentional control. I'm not sure overstimulation is the way to characterize it, but there's some truth. You know, too much noise disturbs a person with autism. Too many things going on at the same time. You just have to limit it somehow. I don't have a particular account for that phenomenon, but it's a phenomenon. It's not a theory. I think it's a very real phenomenon. Also, you know, many people with autism have anxiety. So it could be a heightened level of arousal. But, yes, it's not really an adequate response here, but it's the best I can do just at this minute. So, I'm not going to launch into some of the machine learning studies of word meaning that I and Tom Mitchell and Svetlana Shinkareva and Kaiman Chang and Bin Smolovey have been, and Francisco Pereira and others have been working on. But you can imagine using machine learning to extract the patterns of activation, complex visuospatial patterns of neural activation, and getting the neural representations of concepts, and then importing that kind of into forecaps as the representations of word meaning. So that's kind of a project that we're on. But I think I should stop there. You see, it's sort of an interesting adventure looking at the human operating system. I don't know whether that's the best path to making wonderful robots and artificial systems, but you see a sort of a commonality. It's like studying comparative intelligence. And so here I think we have an interesting characterization of the human system. I don't know that, you know, the components are going to be different in an artificial system. So I don't know whether this is the path to follow, but it's worked for the human race, and maybe there's some good properties associated with it. So I should stop there.
Competitor. Because of this time smearing, how easy is it to validate various models?
Well, it makes it harder. I think it's just a burden that's placed upon all theories. You know, people are waiting for the next technology that won't have that smearing in it. But I don't know what to say. I mean, you can distinguish, you know, you can make predictions about when in the thought process something should occur, and you can see whether it occurs earlier or later. So, I mean, there are modeling papers. I know, I could tell you, if you go to my website, I think there's a four caps paper that gives a lot of what I presented here today. I think it's on there. I'm not positive. If not, it'll be on within a few days. So you could look at that and see it in more detail, because we certainly modeled in much more detail than I've shown you today.
So you have lots of anatomical data that this makes you feel very comfortable about, because it's in good agreement. But the technique is a little bit scary, kind of equivalent to trying to figure out how a car works by looking at it with an infrared camera and looking for the hot spot. And you might see the engine, but on a lot of cars, you'll see the catalytic converter, because it's the hottest place. The answer to that is, well, the agreement with what we learned from the anatomy is very good, but now we'd like to see something predictive. And the other worrisome thing, of course, is that you say 40% of the volume is the wiring, and we don't have a technique for seeing the wiring. What are the prospects for actually seeing the communication?
Let me start with the last thing. First of all, I've sort of skipped, I haven't addressed these issues in my talk here very much, but most of what I've been talking about has been based on fMRI, functional magnetic resonance imaging, that measures the activity. It's really oxygenated blood. Okay, so most of what that and the synchronization between those signals at different places of the brain. I've alluded slightly to cable diameters. And that we do with MRI, just a tissue, where we it's called morphometry, we literally measure, sort of calibrated voxels on the screen. It's automated, but that's what it is. And there's a third imaging modality called diffusion tensor imaging that measures the diffusion of water along particular directions, and you can measure the degree of coherence of the MR signal in any one voxel, where when there's a white matter fiber there, it all has one particular direction, whereas if it's going through gray matter, it's isotropic. So you can measure coherence of each voxel, and you see the white matter pop out, and the coherence is lower in autism than it is in controls at particular points. But I think your fundamental point is, here's a computational system, and all that fMRI does is tell you the amount of activity at each point of the system every 1 second. And that's absolutely right. That's all it does. And it's up to experimental ingenuity to design studies that enable you to make predictions and say, if I do this and if I have the theory right, I should see activation here after 7 seconds or something or other. But that's it. What we're really missing, I think, fMRI would be God's gift to experimental psychology if we knew what the activity was in each area. But we don't. When you think about it, in science, you never see the process. The process is almost always in the scientist's head. If you watch a flower blooming, if you watch a whirlpool, whatever the phenomenon is, the causal explanation isn't there in front of you. It's always in your head or in a scientific theory. And so this is the challenge. Now, this is a better camera or whatever, you said thermograph, or than we've ever had before, to have this incredible spatial resolution, I think not bad temporal resolution. So yes, it's not the ultimate, but it's only going to get better. To give you an example, as I mentioned, we're measuring blood flow and oxygenated blood with this, 3-4 second delay. And this is with a magnetic field strength of 3 Tesla. But you don't really, you're not really interested in oxygen. It's not really primary in the neural computation. You want to see something like the sodium flow. And so as you build 9 Tesla magnets, and people are, they're hoping that they're going to be able to see the sodium flow. It's still not going to tell you exactly what, you know, one little neuron is telling another, but you'll see the flow in much more temporal and spatial detail, maybe temporal or spatial detail. But I think all science is like that. So, you know, when the first microscope was developed, somebody said, ah, but you still can't see, you know, the molecular structure yet. Yeah, you have to wait a few hundred years. And so I think it's a matter of seeing the glasses half empty or half full.
To follow up on that, really, our tools for looking at much higher spatial and temporal resolution, for example, multi-electrode recording, and are you looking at all at trying to integrate other modalities as well as fMRI into the model, possibly a biocast or something like that?
You know, so I'm already sort of ecumenical in incorporating diffusion tensor imaging and MRI with the fMRI. I could go broader. Honestly, you know, to have a laboratory seriously master another technology like that is a big cost, and we haven't done it. And I honestly don't think that our lab is going to do it. But many other labs promise it. You know, tens of them promise at the end of their grant proposals, but a few of them take it rather seriously, and you know, and they try to do the electrophysiological recording actually in the scanner, so you get the two signals simultaneously, and you could bring them together, because you can do then, once you have the fMRI signal, you can do the source localization. It's no longer an equation to solve; you know the answer. So it's kind of a promise held out. That promise has been on the table for, you know, at least 7 years, and it hasn't really been fulfilled, I would say. But, you know, I imagine sometime soon somebody will meet that challenge. So I applaud those who have the energy and the resources to try it.
Identified these highly specialized centers. I'm curious, like, how much does the underlying, the low-level anatomy differ between those two centers in terms of column structure or neurons? Similar? Is it very different?
So, you know, I don't have a good technical answer, but the question was, are the neurons the same throughout the brain? Or so. One of the parcellations of the brain is by what's called Brodmann areas. And Brodmann areas are exactly defined by the cytoarchitectonic properties. And there's tens of Brodmann areas, and the cell types differ. You know, so you see a clump of cells that have, I don't know what the properties are, but they differ in their anatomy. That was your question. And presumably, that anatomy is correlated with some sort of functional property. So, for example, but nobody has that mapping worked out exactly. One example would be, in the auditory cortex, you would think that the cells there are very, very good at doing temporal discrimination. Otherwise, you know, they wouldn't be able to tell one phoneme from another. So, I assume that, you know, we all have the auditory cortex in the same place in the brain, you know, except for special circumstances. And how does that magic happen? I don't think that it's predetermined that that's going to do the auditory processing. I think the cells that are good at that live there. Auditory processing comes along, and those cells get, to use a colleague's term, they get the contract for doing the auditory processing. So I think that the fact that I can point to some area and say this area does that, this area does something else, I think it's because the cell types are different across the cortex. And what I called computational styles, you know, like geometric or propositional, is, you know, the evolution of a set of different kinds of, I don't know what to call it, neuralware, different types that are well suited to different informational capabilities. So
just to follow up real quickly, so how would you account for some, I've read these studies about blind individuals, whereas the visual cortex actually remaps.
Yes.
Yes,
so that's it's very interesting. You know, that's exactly what your question evoked. There's a researcher named Helen Neville, and she actually does electrophysiology, and she studies people who are congenitally blind or deaf, and she finds that the areas, you know, so in a congenitally blind person, what happens in the visual cortex? It turns out that it responds to auditory signals. It gets reused. My guess is that even though it's doing this auditory processing, that it doesn't do as good a job as the auditory cortex is, because it's, you know, it's its second choice of stimulus. So this, I think there's some plasticity in the mapping between the cell types to the computational specialization. But if you look at, you know, if you test people, everybody has language processing in Broca's area. It's not as though some people have it in Broca's area and some people have it. It's all within, everybody's within 5 centimeters of everybody else. But there's some plasticity, as I mentioned in the stroke case, as Neville's evidence has when there's congenital damage to one of the systems. So I've talked about very fundamental things like auditory language comprehension, but you know, we learn to do fantastic things. We learn to read, we learn to write code, and biology didn't prepare us for this. I mean, gave us the machinery, and there you see the opportunity for different kinds of mappings, more variable among people. You know, how you're going to do your coding. You know, maybe one person does it much more visually, maybe another person does it much more propositionally, and so on. You know, we refer to this sort of as strategies, but it needn't be a high-level executive strategy. It just could be the strength of one or another center coming to play for some non-biologically given task.
One last question. Chris.
So one of the basic tests for a theory of the brain is it complicated enough? Our brain does a lot of stuff. And that's sort of anti-science, in the sense of trying to keep things simple. And I'm struck by the 12 areas here. That seems way too small for all the things we do. And it also seems way too small. Earlier you were talking about architectural areas. I believe there are on the order of 40 of them, something like that. You talked about, well, who gets contract? Maybe they're all Halliburtons of some form or another, and all of them are working. But maybe reality is just much more complicated than what we're trying to explain or model or whatever.
Yes, so I'd like to answer in two ways. First of all, when I said 12, 15 areas activate in any given task, but surely the brain has more than 12 centers. It's just we haven't had the energy or, you know, not smart enough to do all of them. But I don't think we have to do 2,000 centers. So maybe you're asking me what's the order of magnitude of the number of centers at this level of resolution. If I'm talking about 1 centimeter diameter centers, in cognitive tasks, when you look at fMRI tasking, you look at a compendia of, you know, 500 experiments, I think you only get 50. Now, maybe it's 75, but I don't think it's anywhere near 2,000. Okay, so we're a little short on that, but not the wrong order of magnitude. But there's another way in which this is not very complex, and that is it doesn't capture other levels of description. So, you know, there are, you know, 10 billion neurons or whatever busily working away, and this doesn't begin to touch them. But, you know, so if there were a perfect theory of the economy, it would have nothing to say about the electrons in the universe. So this theory isn't responsible for all levels of granularity. Right now, we're trying to account for the interactions among the centers, the dynamic configuration. It might not be complex enough for that, but I don't think it's the wrong order of magnitude of complexity. Now, if somebody says, I'd like you to explain why this picture is harder to recognize than that picture, and you know it has some element of low-level visual processing, then, and obviously, you know, any one of these centers could be sort of a lifetime of research, more than a lifetime of research, to understand well. Surely there are, you know, thousands, maybe tens of thousands of people studying the visual cortex, and it's not even in our models. We bypass it. Okay, so yes, of course it's a simplification, but how should I put it? No theory is going to be a 24-volume encyclopedic account of all the phenomena at all the levels. Theories are, you know, sort of written in, I don't know, 200 pages, maybe 50 pages. But nobody, you know, nobody writes an encyclopedic theory.
All right, well, let's thank our speaker again.
Global clarification that kind of follows on to the question, which had, you didn't show us any production.